Hey there, you're very welcome to the seventh and final episode of season two of Triton Lake Perform. My name is Connor Smith, founder and CEO of Triton Lake, a marketplace connecting a network of global sophisticated investors with relevant alternative investment opportunities. In 2021, Triton Lake became the title sponsor of the Ireland men's and women's rugby sevens teams. As we reach the halfway point of the current sevens season, we're starting to look forward to watching both teams compete in the Paris Olympics this summer. Triton Lake Perform explores the intersections of sport and business, looking at what both worlds can learn from each other and what are the key parts to the puzzle of high performance. Our next guest has a wealth of knowledge across both sevens and 15s rugby and the world of high performance. We're delighted to be joined today by ex-English rugby star and now motivational speaker, coach and founder of Optimist Performance, Ollie Phillips. Ollie, thanks very much for joining us today.
Pleasure, mate. Great to be here, Connor. Thanks, mate. Thanks for having me.
Good. Maybe to kick things off, Ollie, you can give us a brief overview of your journey through 15s and 7s up to where you are today in terms of high performance, motivational speaking, all of the other wonderful things you're doing.
Oof, yeah, Jesus, how long have we got? So a very fast summary. My background was 12 years in professional sports. Obviously, rugby was my game. I was at three different clubs, really. Newcastle Falcons, Stade Francais in Paris and Gloucester from a 15s perspective. And then I did about 11 years within the England framework, within the England sort of program. The majority of that was on the sevens, you know, if you like, where I've got a lot of my my fame, if that's what it's called. But so I was 11 years within the England sevens program. I was captain for that group for about 4 years. And then I was, who says that bribery doesn't pay, as they say, or your mum dialing in didn't pay off. But I, 2009 got voted as the best player in the world. So either a dearth of talent or just a ferocious frenzy of people voting. So that was my rugby career. And then a fast summary of post that, I went and sailed around the world, set four Guinness World Records of at the North Pole, going up Mount Everest, cycling across America, and swimming the Channel. So there's a few things for us to talk about, mate. But that's if you like, rugby and adventure in one.
Where did the sevens, had you played a bit of sevens before, or did that come up as part of the England program? Or, you know, maybe talk us through that transition and, you know, the 15s world before the England set up, and just to give a bit more flavour to the rugby side of things.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was just passionate about playing, right? That was my joy. I just loved playing rugby at any opportunity. And then the sevens environment was quite exciting and enticing for me. One, it was faster. It was a bit more frenetic, but yeah, it was also, it provided me the opportunity to travel, which is something that I loved and was obsessed with. So before England and before the international environment, I was involved with things like the public school wanderers and samurai, who are now called shogun. But that allowed me to go. I remember my first ever trip was to Kenya and Zambia with the public school wanderers. And it was the most incredible experience as a 17-year-old lad going for 3 weeks away in Kenya and
amazing.
Zambia to play rugby, you know, and that kind of lit the litmus paper for me around like, oh, wow, I can combine a series of my sort of passion points of like sport, exercise, being a competitor, but also travel, see the world, all that good stuff.
No, great. And if you think about the transitioning, we're seeing a lot of people switching from 15s to 7s with the Olympic year ahead of us and everything, most notably DuPont in France. From your experience, what were the challenges, I guess, in transitioning from one code to the other? Or was it, I guess, on the wing, was it fairly seamless, or how did you think about it?
Oh, I mean, I wasn't fast enough, mate, to play on the wing for the 7s. So I ended up having to play, they just shunted me further and further inside. So I ended up playing fly half and centre. But yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, right? I mean, I was never a big advocate of the fact that, you know, you have to be a specialist in one of the two games. I was always like, look, you know, a tackle is the same principle, the turnover is the same principle, you know, the understanding space and the importance of possession, all these things I think were transferable, whether that's in the 15s and the 7s environment. So I actually found that the sevens environment really helped my 15s progression. Like when I used to come back from the sevens, and I felt super sharp. I felt I felt a lot more accurate. It really helped sharpen and hone my skills on a 15 side. I appreciate now, you know, the games have probably become a bit more divergent rather than convergent now. And I think that's more the speed and the fitness levels that are required for you to transition over. Although Dupont's doing a pretty good go, making a pretty good go of demonstrating it doesn't matter. You just have to be Superman, basically, and it doesn't matter what you do. But so I was always one of those players that I maybe had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder that I wanted to prove that you could, you know, just because you were a sevens player didn't mean that you couldn't be a 15s. And so for me, my move to Stade Francais, which at the time was one of the biggest clubs in Europe, that was an opportunity for me to sort of showcase that actually, like, okay, I've just been voted as the best player in the world in sevens. You know, 2 years later, I got voted as the best player in Europe at 15s. And that was that was quite a big, you know,
statement.
I enjoyed that moment. Yeah, big statement for me.
And if as you think about leadership in the context of sevens and 15s, I mean, we hear a lot about mini leadership groups in 15s. Do you see the role of leaders being different between the two, or is it very similar as well?
Yeah, I think, I mean, now having had some context away from the rugby field, I think what's quite helpful for me is to sort of recognise and appreciate the difference. And where I see leadership being critical is really what you do when pressure comes on. Like, that's the only time it really, you know, how do you show leadership on and off the field in terms of how you drive forward an agenda or a principle and underpin values with key behaviors that sit at the cornerstone, whether you're in 15, sevens, an office, you know, a sailing boat, really, in order for those to get, you know, you establish all those principles, but the acid test comes when the proverbial hits the fan of some sort, you know, pressure basically comes on in some capacity. Sometimes it's extreme, other times it's minute. It can be emotional, physical, mental, financial pressure. And then that's when you see which people really respond and rally to that. And I think what I enjoyed about the sevens more was it, from a leadership perspective, because you were physically and mentally always under pressure because it was so exhausting, I quite enjoyed that part of like the clarity of thought, despite the fact, you know, your legs and your lungs are screaming.
No, absolutely. Maybe you touched there on the Stade Francais move after sevens and everything else, but obviously going to a different culture as well. Did you find that transition to a new culture difficult?
Yeah, I'm huge, mate. I mean, that was part of the allure of it as well. The attraction was, you know, going over to live in, bear in mind, I've been in Newcastle at that point in time, right?
Bit of a difference between Newcastle and Paris.
I mean, they all spoke with dodgy accents, but just a different experience, right? But I think in Newcastle, we used to have like, you know, one man and his dog turn up for a game. You know, I'm joking, but you know, we'd probably have like 5,000 people at Stand. We'd have 80,000 people.
Yeah.
And you know, Newcastle's cracking city, good fun, but it's not a capital city of a huge European country. So I mean, I'll be honest, I was nervous because then you add on the fact that, you know, you're going to go play for Stade Francais in pink and all the sort of history and heritage behind that. It's just a very different challenge to the one at Newcastle. But what I loved about it was embracing a different culture, like seeing the world. It was the first time really that my eyes have been opened up to like what else is out there and how there is so much exploration, if you like, an adventure to be had in the world. And that really sort of fed my soul a bit. So I quite enjoyed the challenge, but I won't lie. The first 6 months were lonely, but luckily I teamed up with James Haskell. So that made that blow a little bit softer because he and I lived together. You know, we were both in the sort of same boat. He's, you know, a barrel of laughs and it really was a welcomed partnership and a welcome distraction.
And could you speak French before you went over, just out of curiosity?
No, nothing. And the challenge in Stade was that everything is in French, all training, everything. And I never forget, like I learned, it took me about 6 months to learn the language. And what didn't help, my first, like it was being at when we got signed, the two coaches were Christophe Dominici, the late Christophe Dominici, sadly, but you know, the French winger, he just finished playing and had gone into coaching. And it was he went on to become the Australian head coach, but a guy called Ewan McKenzie at the time. And he was they were the two head coaches. Within 6 weeks of us being there, Ewan McKenzie got fired. So that didn't go according to plan. And then they brought in this bloke called Jacques Delmas, who was as French as they come. And I never forget, I didn't understand what he was saying all the time. So he used to call me the poulet sans tête and the poisson rouge, which basically means the goldfish and the headless chicken. Right? Those are the two things he called me to. But he used to start me every game. He just said I was so energetic and I run around like a headless chicken. But he used to look at, if I'd look at him off the side of the field or whatever, he'd just start making like these at me as if I'm like instigating. I'm either a goldfish or a
headless chicken.
Like pretend, yeah, headless chicken started running around, clucking his arms at me, and I was like, this is ridiculous. But it's the only way I could communicate with him. But you know, they've got a nuanced way, the French. But I loved it,
and you loved it. Would you say that was your most enjoyable part of your 15s career?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't get me wrong, I was very grateful and I really enjoyed my time in Newcastle, and I came through with an incredible group of players. Bear in mind, obviously, Wilco was there at that point, so we had, you know, had that as a role model to see. But you know, the group of players that I came through in the academy and then the under 21, second team, then playing on the first team, that was Jeff Parling, Lee Dixon, Matthew Tate, Toby Flood, Ben Woods, all these players that went on to play for England, Saxons, won the Premiership, all the rest of it at different clubs. So you know, Phil Dowson, Davey Wilson, they were all, Carl Heyman, all of these players were, like I was, you know, playing with at that point in time. So that was a really incredible experience for us and for me.
Yeah.
And then obviously in 09, we kind of all went our own way in, to, you know, different clubs, and it all sort of disbanded, and Stade was just a different level. I love my time at Gloucester, don't get me wrong, that was a great experience, but more of a frustrating one because I got quite a few injuries when I was there as well. But Stade was the pinnacle.
And maybe just touching on that injury thing to wrap up the rugby part of the conversation, obviously injury prevented you from leading Team GB in the Olympics. How difficult was that to come to terms with?
I mean, really hard, mate. I'll be honest, my transition away from the sport was I found very, very difficult. I think it's a cutthroat environment, let's be honest. Like, it's a cutthroat professional environment. And, you know, I went at, I was 29. I'd been told that I had a three-year contract and that, you know, stay within the Sevens program. I'd had a couple of contract offers from Sale and from Harlequins, actually. And I turned those down. And I said, like, I'm going to go for the Sevens. I'm going to go for the Olympics, you know, and literally within the space of, I mean, honestly, 5 hours, the whole thing changed. My contract I got told that contract was no longer there. Obviously with that, I was no longer going to be in the GB, in the England framework and the mixer. And then obviously the hammer blow came. You know, we don't really know what the hell's the matter. We think you've severed the nerve in your calf and that's it, you know. I said, you're done. I was like, what do you mean I'm done? Like, I can't be done. But
what's my rehab? You're asking, right? Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, that's how I've been habitualized all my life, all the way through. Like not even in professional rugby, but you know, you get an injury. Well, what have I done? Okay, cool. Tell me what I've got. You know, how do we make it better? Oh, well, you know, do this. Okay. How long is it going to take? All right. Well, I'll do more than that. And you need to do 20 reps. Okay. I'll do 30 reps. And how long? 6 months. Or I'll be back in three. You know, that was always my mindset. So then for someone to turn around and say, like, there isn't a solution here, that was pretty difficult to deal with.
Yeah. And then obviously you turned to taking on some extreme adventures to take yourself out of that mindset. How long was it, but I guess, between that 5 hours and the embryo of an idea that you're going to take on some of these extreme adventures?
Not even the embryo, like actually doing it, was 6 weeks.
Wow. Talk us through that.
So I remember I got carried off the field, having done something to my calf. I'd had a problem with my calf all all year, but had done something to it, got carried off. And that was at the World Cup training camp for the World Cup in Moscow. Also, now wasn't going to the World Cup. And they sort of fed all this information, contracts gone, da 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 da. It was pretty disastrous. And then, as always, Connor, thankfully, in your deepest, darkest hour of need, there is always a, in my case, drunken Irishman somewhere in the world to help me. And on this case, it wasn't you, but it was a guy called Sir Robin Knox-Johnson, who I know well. He was the first person to ever single-handedly sail around the world. He's a big rugby fan. And he founded this thing called the Clipper Around the World Race. And he actually rang me at the time, I think, to goad and gloat, because we just got panned in the World Cup final against New Zealand. I think it was 33-3 or something like that. And I've found that the Irish are very humble and magnanimous when England lose, very supportive when we lose. So he rang me up, I think, to gloat, realised I was having a fairly rubbish day when I told him about my leg and everything else like that. And he said, well, look, actually, look, give me a day. But there's something we've just done on the Clipper Around the World Race, which is a sailing race that he founded. And we've just signed a really late deal with Downing Street. They want to do this campaign about, it's called the Great Campaign, an Olympic legacy program from 2012 that champions everything that's great about Britain. So, you know, podcasts are great, business is great, travel's great, adventure's great, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we need an ambassador. They want like a trade envoy to be the representative for Great Britain. You'd be perfect. And I was like, Jesus Christ. And I said, well, when does it all leave? What is it? He was like, oh, it's 46,000 miles around the world. You'd be 11 months at sea. And I was like, well, okay, like, I've never sailed before, so, and I can't really walk my leg.
Yeah, so, that was my next question. You can't really walk either, yeah.
So, well, don't worry, it's going to be so rough that you'll be on your hands and knees anyway, so you won't need to walk. So I was like, Robin, mate, you need to stay away from sales and marketing because you're not selling this very well. But I said, look, when does it leave? He said, you need to do 3 weeks training, and then and it leaves in 6 weeks' time. So I was like, okay. So I said, yeah, sod it, I'm in, let's go. So within 6 weeks, I did my 3 weeks training, moved out of my flat in Clapham, and jumped on a boat and set sail to go around the world.
And what kind of condition is your calf in this at this point?
Not good. Yeah. Not good. Hobbling around. But because it was neural, if the nerve calmed down, it was sort of like I could walk and it'd be fine. And then other days it wouldn't be so fine. But I think the important thing to understand at that point in time with my mindset and my mental frame of mind is I still was in my mindset like a rugby player. That's all I was, right? This was a temporary pause, and I had a bit of delusions of grandeur that, you know, oh, what do these people know? I'll do this adventure, I'll go sail around the world, I'll come back, I'll be 30-31, like, and I had this sort of amazing story in my head that, like, the first port of call on the sailing race was Rio de Janeiro. So we went, like, you know, across the Atlantic to Rio. That's where we stopped first.
Yeah.
And I was like, and then my last port of call on my rugby career could be Rio 2016 Olympics. Yeah. So I was like, oh, you know, it's written in the stars. It's going to be amazing. I'll come back. I'll do 2 years training. I'll get back and play. But, and I got close, mate. I got very close. But I'll be honest, I get on well with him. But Simon Amor at the time, not screwed me. I came back to England. I'd done the Clipper race. I trained like an absolute Trojan for 6 months to get myself fit, and just asked him, look, I don't want any money, I don't want a contract, but can I just come and train with the team, come be in the framework so you can sort of see what I'm like? And he said no.
Okay.
He said no. So okay. that was a bit galling, and that was very frustrating for me at the time, because I wanted to have a go. As it turned out, I went away. I actually played a tournament with Samurai, which was kind of like an England A team, and my calf flared on me.
Okay.
Which gave me the signals of like, yeah, this is not going to work. But it was sort of pretty frustrating for me at that point in time. I couldn't really understand why I couldn't just come and train, given my background and I didn't think I was a particularly negative influence in the group. No, for whatever reason, he said that.
Exactly. You would have thought that a prior captain for a number of years would be a good person to have around a squad, right?
But you only see, I mean, talking of leadership, right? You only see, sometimes you only see the world through your own lens, right? So, and I was definitely seeing the world through my own lens of like, you know, I can't understand why you wouldn't want to do this or why you would block this. But yeah, I still don't obviously understand it, but he saw the world through a very different lens and I wasn't in it. So
you weren't in it. Exactly.
That's fair enough.
Yeah. Switching gears then slightly, how was the calf when you played the highest ever game of rugby in Mount Everest? Talk us through that story.
Oh, my. Well, nobody wanted the ball, so I tried to do as little walking, let alone running, as possible. I mean, it was the most incredible experience and, I'll be honest, one of the most incredible achievements. But it was brutal as a challenge. I mean, you at 6,500 meters up in the air, you struggle to let alone, you know, breathe, let alone run around and catch a rugby ball. So to add that into the dimension was definitely challenging. But it was cool, right? No one ever done it before. It was one of those things. I can assure you, kind of the standard was not quite up to the HSBC World 7 Series, but of the quality of rugby on show. But it was just an incredible achievement, and you know, it was all for a charitable cause, the Wooden Spoon. So all of that just felt right, and it was a great experience because of that.
And then maybe before we move off some of these extreme adventures, do you want to touch on some of the other ones, maybe the magnetic North Pole and those kind of bits as well?
Yeah. So look, when I finished, like truth be told, there was probably about 2-3 years after that episode of, you know, with Simon and me trying to come back, where I really struggled with the identity piece, the loss of identity. My whole life had been consumed by being a rugby player, and I identified myself as a rugby player. I even found it in conversation. I would introduce myself to people, even though I'd retired or finished playing like a year and a half, 2 years prior, I'd still introduce myself as like, oh, hi, I'm Ollie. I used to play rugby.
Yeah.
You know, whereas instead of like, oh, hi, I was working at PwC at that point, I would never introduce myself and say, oh, hi, I work for PwC. Never. Yeah. Not once.
Wasn't your identity.
So, you know, yeah. I couldn't identify with it. My identity was as a rugby player. So I really struggled for probably 2-3 years on that piece of like, okay, moving away and whatever you want to call it, letting go. And I think some of those things were, you know, the fallout, the trauma, if you want to call it, and were for positive reasons, and other ones were for negative reasons. You get a bit full of your own ego. You get a bit of, you know, the vanity piece when you play for England, you play rugby, you know, you've got 80,000 people who support you around the world, da, 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 like that gets addictive, right? You're a somebody, in inverted commas, and I still think I crave to be a bit of a somebody at those points. So I'd say, some of those adventures of the early part were now on reflection, maybe fueled by a little bit of ego, but also a lot of charitable causes and good things too, right? So good sentiment, good reason. So the North Pole, Everest, sailing around the world, all of those were done in memory of my grandmother who died of Alzheimer's, and for the children's charity, the Wooden Spoon. And, you know, now when I look back, all those challenges, and it's obviously still an ongoing piece, but they've all been cumulatively, now we've managed to raise just over £3 million from doing those things. And you know, that's a remarkable achievement and an incredible achievement from everybody involved, not just myself. So but I think it also made me realize how much I just love adventure and doing other bits out in the world, and having the opportunity to not sail around the world, go to the North Pole, go up Everest, cycle across America, race a rickshaw across India, you know, all these things were just stuff that probably hadn't really dreamt of or thought about. But people were just like, oh, I've got this crazy idea. You seem like a lunatic. Do you fancy doing it? And I was like, yeah, why not? You know, let's go for it.
Yeah.
And life's for living, not for chilling, is what we're saying.
Absolutely. And what was the toughest of all of those challenges that you did?
I think in terms of like the attritional nature of it and just the sheer duration of it, the Clipper race, the sailing race because it was 11 months at sea.
So yeah.
You know, and that was sort of hard slog. And then in terms of like physically just breaking you down, Everest. Yeah, I mean, I have never experienced like this, that weird dichotomy between sort of like euphoria and displeasure. I mean, like you were euphoric and in absolute awe of where you were, but then suffering because you just can't breathe. You can't, you've realized just how sort of, if like out of control you are. Like you are totally at the mercy of Mother Nature.
Yeah.
And for every step you take, you're just exaggerating that.
No.
And you're just compounding that sentiment and that misery. So that was, you know, but that was a much shorter time scale. That was like, what, 6 to 7 weeks. So, you know, that was nowhere near as long as the Clipper race, but physically demanding that one, definitely.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And you're just, I know exactly what you mean about that, conscious of how, you know, inconsequential you really are versus Mother Nature, right? So
100%. Yeah. I mean, it was an incredible feeling. I'd never had that feeling before, but I remember standing like at the foot of Everest and being like in awe of it, in awe. And until you've been there, I think once you speak to someone that's been there, they understand. But like, I've just never had that feeling of like, wow, like I've never seen something that has made me realize how, as you say, like how inconsequential I am.
I
am not in control here. No, this thing is in control.
Yeah.
And I need to respect it. I need to admire it. And I need to appreciate it. And I need to let go of my ego.
And
I need to recognize. Yeah, and be careful. Like when the right time just to turn back, right? This is one of those few environments. And obviously all my life I've been in an environment where you just work harder. You just punch on. You just do more. And this is one of the environments where, like, you know, you've got to play smart. If you do more, you're done.
Yeah.
When you're in trouble, if you do more, extreme scenarios, you're dead.
There's no safety net. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
Maybe just moving across to the business world, tell us a little bit about what you're doing now and, you know, how you see all of your life experiences, I guess, to date, contributing to that and, you know, where you're going to go from here.
Yeah. So, I mean, all these adventures and everything else that we've done and that we've been involved in, it's all been about how do you bring, let's say, disparate groups of people together, even rugby, you know, disparate groups of talented people together to go and achieve something remarkable. You know, and that involves how do you help instill belief? How do you develop and nurture expertise? How do you identify talent? How do you champion mindset and behaviors? All those things, right? So I reflected on all that and realized that I loved it, right? I really was really passionate about that and developed, you know, building world-class performance environments, world-class performance teams and cultures. And as a result, like, I founded Optimus Performance, well, nearly 10 years ago now. And the crux of what we do is, you know, in essence, we create situations and scenarios that will stress test the behavior. And what do I mean by that? So, you know, when we were, for example, in Everest, and there was a guy with us who, unfortunately, his lung collapsed at 6,500 meters. Right, that is an intense experience and an incredible level of like pressure, if you like, that comes on, obviously, the individual, but each individual and the group, and how you respond to that, and how you think clearly, make decisions, solve the problem with a positive outcome and then be conscious of all the ripple effects of that come from that decision of, like, you know, fear that other people are worried they're going to happen, that the same's going to happen to them, making sure that the person gets down safely and doesn't die, like, genuinely, like, at 6,500 meters, they're in a lot of trouble. So, like, don't get me wrong, we don't take people up 6,500 meters and collapse their lungs and see how, you know, how people deal with it, but you know, how do we create, if people come to us all the time saying, like, you know, we want to get better at leading or collaborating or having challenging conversations, and for us it's okay, right, well, let's create as many situations and scenarios so that you can practice it, because what I found in the corporate and commercial world is something that's in stark contrast to my sporting world. In my sporting world, all we ever did was practice, 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 practice in pursuit of that, the big game, whatever that big game was at the end, the big moment, right? Or a World Cup or an Olympics or whatever it is. Practice, practice, practice for that moment so that when it arrives, you're comfortable and you're capable to deliver. All I see in the commercial corporate world is they just play, 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 play. They never practice, 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 never. So they leave a lot of stuff to chance. And I've got so many examples of this where people have had big meetings or challenging conversations, and they've never rehearsed them. They've never practiced it. They've just left it totally down to the fact of, like, you know, Connor's really good at this. He'll just do it. And the reality is that sometimes they get it right, obviously, but other times they get it wrong. And when you get it wrong, it has sort of pretty dramatic and, you know, fairly significant consequences. So if through our business, we can provide as many opportunities for people to get exposure to different kinds of pressures, different kinds of scenarios, different kinds of stresses that allows them to keep continually practicing, then, you know, I know that when it comes to the actual moment where they need to do it in real life, in the live, they're going to be a lot better at it. So that's sort of what we do.
That's what you do, which makes a lot of sense. And obviously your plan, I guess, going forward is to grow that and make that accessible to more and more companies and teams.
Yes, mate. Yeah. So we're still a relatively small business. We've got a core team of 8, and then we've got about 25-30 optimists that we call them eternal optimists, that are, you know, if like specialists in certain areas that we need at certain times. And we're working with some really great clients. We've been all over the place now. We've done some stuff in the predominantly UK, obviously, but done stuff in South America, the US, parts of Europe. So it's cool. Like our whole modus operandi is, how do we help people go from, you know, good to great or great to world class? How do we help instill that from a behaviors perspective? What does that look like? Yeah. How do you live and breathe them? How do we challenge you around them? And how do we help you develop them? And we do that through like a diagnostics, we've done some surveys, we do executive and group coaching, we'll do behavioral change workshops, you know, but it's all around experiences. Like, how do we put you continually into these environments that are going to allow you to get better?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, that's just about it, I think, Ollie. I think in terms of a last question for you, we've asked a lot of our guests when we finish up, what's the one piece of advice that you'd give someone that was looking to establish themselves as a leader in a high performance environment? I guess from your journey, is there something there in particular you would point at?
Absolutely. So as a 19-year-old lad, when I walked into Newcastle Falcons my first week, there was a sadly no longer with us, but there was an inspirational character, a guy called Steve Black, who was the man behind Johnny Wilkinson's sort of rise to greatness, if you like. And he was our, whatever you call it, S&C, but he was more than that at Newcastle. But all I remember is he came to me and he said, look, he turned around to me, he's this little short, squat, fat Geordie bloke, absolute hero. And he turned around to me and he said, look, Ollie, maximize your strengths, manage your weaknesses. I was like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about, Blackie? And he's like, look, you're going to meet loads of coaches, you're going to meet loads of people throughout your life. Some of them will be brilliant, some of them will be terrible. And he said, the great ones are going to be the ones that understand you and recognize your X factor, because that's what's got you through the door. That's why you're in the change room, because you've got X factor. You do something different that we've seen to, you know, everyone else that's out in the market, which is why we brought you here. So he said, that's your strength. So, and he said, look, you've only got 24 hours in a day. You need to sleep 8 of them at least. So he said, out of the other 16 that you have available, make sure you invest the majority of them into the things that you're super strong at, your super strengths, your X factor, because that's what's got you through the door. But, and he said, with the rest of the time, invest it into the, you know, just manage the weakness areas so that they don't become a route for, you know, people firing you or people not picking you or whatever else. But, you know, he said, trust me, if you walk on the field, I was a try scorer, right? So if you walk on the field and you score 5, no one's going to care if you've let in 2, right?
Yeah.
But he said, you know, if you walk on the field and you score 2 and you let in 4, okay, then we need to, you know, we need to adjust the balance a bit. But he said, look, you know, make sure the, he said, but what you'll find is there are loads of crap coaches out there. Those are really poor coaches that you turn up with your X factor. I don't know if you can see my hands right now, but my hands are apart. You start with your X factor. Here's your super strength. Here's your weakness. The time gets invested in this, so they just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
If you invest it in this, you have to neglect your strength. As a result, you just end up here, end up in the middle, and then you're sort of average. You know, the jack of all trades. And he said, no one signs average players.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, just stick with that. And it stayed true with me forever. So, you know, the greatest skill I can say is, if, even for a leader in their environment, like, understand your super strength, maximize it. Don't be intimidated by, like, bringing in other people with other super strengths around you. That's the whole point of a team, right?
That's it, exactly.
That's what makes a great team. Yeah. You don't have to know everything. Just be really good and confident at what you're good at, and then recognize who else you need to bring in to support you on that journey.
Yeah, no, great. Well, Ollie, thanks very much for joining us today. It's been really interesting to hear your story. I'm sure there's lots more to come from Ollie Phillips over the years to come, and we look forward to keeping an eye on that and seeing where you go.
Pleasure, mate. Absolute joy. Always lovely to see you. Love the Triton Lake family. So keep in touch, mate. And yeah, thank you ever so much for having me on the show.
So that's all for season 2 of Triton Lake Perform. As always, thanks for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed the season, and we look forward to bringing you more conversations with fantastic guests next season.